Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblath, and this is Bookworm. Well, things are happening very, very quickly for my guest, John Darnielle. His very first novel, Wolf in White Van, it's published by Farrar Straus, which is an accomplishment. They're around one of the very top
literary presses in New York.
Yes. And they've published his first novel. He is known as the songwriter and lead singer for the Mountain Goats, and I guess it's my suspicion that this has been a dream of yours from the word go to write a novel. Am I right?
In a way, but not in a, it wasn't something in the back of my mind going, well, I hope I write a novel someday. It's more something when I was a child, I assumed, like, that's where I was going. My love of books was profound. It was really my first, except for music. It was not really a contest, but I can never say which one has meant more to me. But I got a typewriter for my sixth birthday, I think, and I started writing short stories. And I mean, I really wanted to make books. But when I started trying to write prose when I was 12 and 13, I couldn't make the stories go longer than 1,000 or 2,000 words. I had nothing more beyond that. And so I turned to poetry. So it's a compressed form, and then from poetry to song. And it occupied most of me. I didn't think much about novels until I wrote Master of Reality, which is a work of criticism sheathed in a story. And that's when I started thinking, well, you know, I'm grown now. I could probably write a novel if I had a story to tell. And I started to think. And then it really did start to, like, the vision took hold of me, and it was like, and it was an old vision that was stored somewhere deep in the recesses of my mind, and it was nice to have a thing to turn to that I hadn't done. You know?
Well, you wrote song upon song, and the Mountain Goats was one of those bands that had uncountable numbers of EPs,
a few
songs on compilation discs. Now, how many full-length albums?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't keep track. And the thing is, like, I'm only ever focusing on whatever I'm working on. And so it's several, at least 10. I'm not quite sure beyond that.
So much so that there are those who started a write-in ballot demanding that John Darnielle be considered for Poet Laureate of America.
Which I do, is an honor I would have to decline to a better poet than myself. There's several.
And you began writing poetry fairly early, too. Do I understand that your poetry had won awards when you were quite young?
Yeah, when I was in high school, my teacher, Rosemary Adam, to whom I owe all, her class entered all the contests and was sort of the gunslinger class of poets from Southern California. Our people tended to win the contests we entered, and I won the Cal Poly one. I took first, which I was shocked. I think I got honorable mention the following year. I didn't think that was going to happen, and I got some honorable mentions and thirds here and there. Then my adolescence went the way it went, and I got kind of into drugs and did less work for several years. But that's where I was heading. I had visions of being a very successful poet.
And then, yes, in the 33 and a third series, which asks writers to write critical works on their favorite albums, John Darnielle chose to write about Black Sabbath, the album, their third, Master of Reality, largely because he'd been in his own music, although it's kind of folkish and rather sedate. It's about coping, and it's about the emotions of loneliness and being shut out that heavy metal is famous for.
And aggression and being upfront with what your thoughts are and getting them out as honestly as you can, right? Which is a very folk thing. There's a folk, Black Sabbath is not unconnected to that movement, I don't think.
Wolf in White Van by my guest John Darnielle is a novel about pain and about coping.
Right.
It's not a novel about coping, then pain.
Right.
It's a novel about pain and learning how to cope
right.
with it. So the book is told to us after the narrator, Sean, he's now 23 years old, and he's looking back at a time when he was 17.
I think he's a little older. I didn't fix his age. He's a grown man, but I think he's a little older than 23.
Uh-huh. But he was no longer able to cope.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And he hurts himself. He mutilates himself. And then he learns to cope very slowly. And when he's in the hospital, because I would say that he learns to cope by accepting gradations of nothingness.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. By learning to look at things closely.
So he's in the hospital bed, looking up at the ceiling.
Right.
And imagining realms of infinite difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Between this shade of white and that.
Right.
Okay. Here's John Darnielle reading from Wolf in White Van.
People have ideas and theories about coping with catastrophic injury, but most of them are based in practicalities. They're right in thinking that the practicalities, how will you live, what will you do, are important, but these aren't the main thing. The main thing is what happens to your vision, how you're a little different after you've seen a few things. And as far as I know, nobody really gets this, though I thought Chris Haynes did once. Something in his overall distrust of the path going forward felt moored to some bigger thing I knew about, something he'd either inferred from the play or known instinctively, but maybe not. It's hard to say. One way of coping, anyway, is to stare at the ceiling. A hospital room ceiling, white, like an egg in a carton that's been in the refrigerator for several weeks, away from the light, is dull, completely uniform, revealing variations only when you stare at the same spot for some time and then very slowly venture out. If you concentrate hard enough on the task, you might find a bubble or grain or a brush or a roller has stopped to reverse its stroke. You could let your attention rest there for a while. You could imagine the future of the ceiling, the battles playing out up there, camps pitched when the building was new, back in unremembered time. You could picture the paint beginning to crack and fragment and see, either in your mind's eye or out there on the actual field of play if your vision spreads that far, the plaster underneath it learning to follow the cracks, the mildew forming on residues left by cleaning solutions beginning to breed, and colonies of microscopic life forms, hostile to dull matter, developing their ruthless, mindless strategy, consume, reproduce, survive. You can see the hospital when the building has been emptied of patients, but a few workers remain, administrators, janitors, members of the demolition crew. You can see the ceiling in the next room, following the splits of the ceiling and its neighbor, and the one beyond that in turn, and then the greater canvas, the sky at night gone flat and painted white, the constellations in the cracking paint, the dust the cracks bring into being as they form, finding free land where none had been before their coming. Nurses and doctors come and go, and family. It's like they're visiting a person at his lonely outpost on the space station miles above the Earth. How do they get there? Just coming in through the door like that. In the brief moment between infinite communion with the ceiling and the beginning of whatever conversation they've come to strike up, it seems like the deepest mystery in the world. So when I remember the ceiling, I try to invest it with meaning somehow. I try to connect its cracks and bubbles to palpable things out there in the world, to things I might have run across later. I treat the imperfections like tea leaves. I remember it as vividly as I can, and I look for shapes in things too small to have any visible shape, and I see centaurs or cavemen or trowels or piles of bricks, and I try to draw lines between the shapes and the slow, sweet life I built for myself when I finally got out and learned I wasn't, thank God, welcome at home anymore. but eventually I look at what I'd known I'd find up there all along, what I'd been seeing already in brief seconds of lucidity arising from the murk of those nights become days and those days of no light. I see my own face. I see it as it was, preserved in stray signals too late to read right. I'm pretty sure that's the lesson there was to learn in the hospital, the main one. And I'm pretty sure my play was the right one to make, because the unnamed every player who lies in the weeds at the moment of Trace Italian's opening move, that's me. It's me. Motionless, ready for something, awake and aware. When the player gets up from the weeds, as he or she always does, because the first move is rigged and all players arrive persuaded that they must act, everything changes. He enters a world where danger's everywhere. He has a goal now, something to do with his life. His map is marked. He's headed somewhere as he rides down the desolate plain. But this is the point where we split, the player and I. He heads for the road to seek shelter or something to eat, but I remain in the stasis of the opening scene, bits of gravel sticking to my face, cold night coming on. I am strong enough to endure it. I am strong enough to remain in its arms forever. I won't get up. I have seen the interior once. I'm not going back. One thing I've learned is it's better sometimes, in the weeds, to resist the temptation to stand up and follow the compass.
John Darnielle, reading from an early section in Wolf in White Van. Now, usually, when we're reading, people tend to escape into visionary fullness. Mm. This boy escapes into visionary emptiness.
Yes, yeah.
And he becomes something that John Barth imagines in the story Lost in the Funhouse. He says, I began to fantasize being the person who runs the funhouse.
Right, right.
The person who gets people lost in the maze. I was no longer one among others. I'm the person watching the lovers get lost in the funhouse.
That's a good spot.
Yeah. And what Sean does is to invent a game by mail in which people are in a post-apocalyptic desert,
right,
trying to get back to a fort, a right, place of safety called Trace Italian.
Right.
And they're given options. It's like they receive a chapter of an adventure in the mail, and then they have to do an interactive thing.
Right, they have to pick one of four ways.
Choose their next move. That's why we hear about the play and about the character named Chris Haynes. They've had original ways of playing.
Right.
And then there are others who have disastrous ways of playing. Lance and Carey.
Right.
Who take the game off the page,
right, right,
and
right,
go out to freeze in a frozen landscape.
Yeah, yeah.
One of them suffering from hypothermia.
Hypothermia, yeah, and
yes,
frostbite.
The other dying.
Other dies.
And so this young man, already so badly hurt, sees himself potentially as the person in charge of hurting others. And it's a little bit like the famous case, was it Judas Priest?
Yep, that was James Vance and Ray Belknap, and their families sued Judas Priest.
The heavy metal band.
Yeah.
So
James and Ray were young men who had a lot of issues. They were super into heavy metal, and they liked to get together and get high and break stuff. And they had a suicide pact, but it seems to have sprung up, like, you know, just in one day. Although I guess Ray had talked about it a lot, but they got high all day and listened to a lot of music, and then went off to a playground and with a shotgun, and each shot himself, and one died, and the other was terribly disfigured. And the one who was disfigured sued Judas Priest, and they were subpoenaed to come to Reno. And there's a movie of it called Dream Deceivers that documents the trial, where it was alleged that that Judas Priest had put backwards messages in the recordings in order to compel young people to hurt themselves.
And one of those backwards messages was?
Well, not Wolf and White Van is from a different one. Wolf and White Van is from people who believe in backwards masking find it everywhere. And there's a Christian, the inventor of Christian rock, Larry Norman, right, wrote a song called 666. It's been covered by Frank Black. That somebody on a reverse speech site claimed, if you play it backwards, it says Wolf in White Van. And that I really loved because it sort of is trying to locate a message, and then the message that comes through is incoherent. You know, you can't. What can
and
you do with that?
Backward messages were said to be messages from Satan.
From Satan, or sometimes from it depends. People have various, the people who you find talking about it now, for the most part, like to talk about it being a function of the subconscious, right? I mean, any explanation you try and come up with is not going to work because it's like, no, the devil, why? Sean rightly asks, why would the devil go through such a ridiculous process, right? Why wouldn't he just reach out to you, you know? Why would he hide these messages where you're never going to find them, you know?
Well, I remember the day, and it was one day.
Yeah.
It went all around the dorm. I was in college. We all had very cheap stereos back then. You couldn't easily play a record backwards.
Right, you had to dislodge the belt.
Yes. But Abbey Road had come out, and the word was that there was a message saying, I murdered Paul.
I buried Paul.
Buried Paul.
Yeah.
Right, and if you looked at the cover, the Beatles crossing the street are all wearing shoes
except for George Harrison.
You
no,
know
wait.
It better than
Paul's
me.
Paul's barefoot. George Harrison is supposed to be dressed as a grave digger.
That's
I mean,
right.
I love this is in this book. I love all these because they're like, you know, the line that I'm always quoting from Diddy, and we tell ourselves stories in order to live, right?
Yes.
Well, these are people telling themselves stories in order to impose order on something when there is no order there, you know, and it's so interesting to me that, like, and the order that they see is so often malevolent, you know, that's what they're looking for.
Now, you are famous among your fans who listen to Mountain Goats for the suggestion that you've lived a miserable life involving a lot of coping mechanisms akin to that found in death metal and heavy metal. I think it's seductive to you. I somehow think that it's not entirely true.
To what isn't true?
The level of suffering.
Oh, no, I don't think I'm famous for suffering. I think I'm famous for surviving and being triumphant. I mean, it's like that's I am
okay.
I run victory laps around my past and that's what I do, right? And so I encourage others to do that also. If you see my shows, right? Our shows are big celebrations. I don't go up there and suffer. I go up there and light everything on fire, right? So we're very, what we do is celebration with all the darkness present, instead of doing a mindless sort of celebration where you say, well, everything's nice, because everything isn't nice, right? But it's lovely to be alive. It's just fantastic, right? No matter suffering or no, it's tremendous to be alive. And that's what the Mountain Goats are about, is like a full-scale acknowledgement of what our lives are or have been like and a fist raised in the air that we're all still here.
Is that what it's like for Sean?
No, the book is a completely different deal. It's like the book I'm talking about other parts of life, you know, because music, even the darkest music, is essentially 100% affirmative. Music is the most gigantic affirmation that human beings are capable of, right? It's like, and that's what music is doing. That's what death metal is doing. It's what Xenakis is doing. It's what, and no matter what kind of music you're writing, you are affirming that we were put here to sing, right? And when we sing, we announce the joy of creation. When we write, we write to erase things in a way, I think. You know, I think writing is about drawing lines around things and saying what's not in there. It's about the elimination of negative space and stuff. So it's a very different, and writing is just a field of music isn't simple, like I'm saying, but I'm kind of a zealot about how I feel about music. Whereas with literature, my take on it is a lot broader and a lot more about asking questions, right? And asking questions, hopefully, that I only like the ones that I don't know the answers to, you know? So it's a very different field. It's a different part of myself that comes out in the book, I think.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with John Darnielle about his book, Wolf in White Van, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and chosen as the next Bookworm, Book Club, Angel Book will continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Darnielle about his new book, Wolf in White Van, about a pair of teens who take a very real journey through a damaged man's imaginary world. Now, that's one of many ways of describing.
I really liked that one, though. That was really good. It's like I was like relishing that.
And one of the things that I noticed, because I'm a, you know, I'm a scrambler. I scrambled to see, well, who is this John Darnielle? And, well, among his influences and admirations are my own hero, William Gass, and many of our heroes, Joan Didion, and the wonderful Catalan novelist, Mercè Rodoreda.
Death in Spring was the one I was trying to remember. Oh, no, the last one, yeah.
Willa Cather. And I saw, oh, he's serious. Oh, okay. Okay. I'll take a look. And the book has the quality that some of the best books have of installing what I would say is a new kind of dread in the reader. I felt genuinely shaken by the condition. I mean, we all wonder, what if back then, when everything was going wrong, what if I really had wrecked things sufficiently to have destroyed myself?
I think there's a lot of that in this book, that thing that, you know, and I can point to specific days in my adolescence when I was really going to do something horrible, you know, and if I had, everything could be very different. There's a whole different book you could have written where if he would have been incapacitated, you know, instead he's disfigured.
You talk about two things in various interviews. One, how you started making little books that you put in a box that were just quotes from here or there, and that you kept them and never showed them to anyone. And the second, that you wrote songs. I think there's a song where all the words are drawn from Akebe's novel, Things Fall Apart.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And there is, as much as there is an interest in empathetic exploration of character, a kind of interest in poetry.
An informal experimentation.
Yes, where there's nothing to be done. You can't understand it. You just have to live with it. You mentioned Chelsea
Minnis.
Yes.
Ah, she's so good.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah, I think she's spectacular. And she's in no hurry. I love that. It's like, I think there's enough people who are excited enough by her that she could probably have another book out by now, but she seems to be in no hurry at all. It's really inspiring.
Yeah, and I wondered, in terms of your own literary trajectory, this is a very accessible book. Very good for new readers, very good for readers just starting to get their taste, to dip their toes in what I call the literary novel. Other people may not like that term, but
no, I'm fine with it. It's very flattering.
But do you intend to write books that can't be read as well?
So it's funny. I had one that I was working on at one point for no, you know, it was formless. It was just like I was writing in a notebook and I was doing stuff more in the, you know, the hard sentence thing. It was partly because when you read Gass, you really want to write a sentence that's as good as the ones that he does, sentence after sentence after sentence, and everyone is perfect, and they're just so... you know who else? Gary Lutz is another...
He's kind of amazing.
And he's incredible. Yeah. I was inspired by that kind of stuff. That's not what I do. I have to have a heavy emotional core at what I do somewhere to feel fully rooted in it. But I also want, you know, I'm kind of greedy. It's like I want that, but I also want, you know, to be doing something that's playful. And But right now, I'm interested in dialogue because this book has so little of it, but I feel the scenes where people are talking to each other, the book kind of seems to jump. You know, there's a little, that scene in the parking lot or the scene in the hospital that you cite, there's this sudden quickening, right? And I'm interested in how that, in what that does, you know, in moving from interior description to people talking to each other, which is the opposite of description. It's something, it's theater, it's a different place, you know? And so yeah, I mean, I have a lot, there's a lot I would like to do in writing.
What's next, more music or another book, or do you not distinguish?
I do distinguish, but I mean, I don't, both. I'm always writing songs and, you know, and yeah, I have a lot of ideas for books and I hope to write another one. But I mean, I have a bunch of songs. We've recorded a whole bunch of songs and I expect there'll be a new album before too long. And, but the other book, it's like, I want to get more ambitious. I think I consider this an ambitious book, but there's, you know, your limits on your ambition are how much are you willing to risk? You know, how hard are you willing to work? And I really want to work very hard. I've been reading lots of Robrier and it's like, and the thing is, he's so fun. This is the big secret about a lot of experimental literature is it gets a bad rap.
Especially The Erasers.
Oh yeah, The Erasers is fun, but Maison de Rendezvous is incredibly fun. You know, he's just a fun writer, although apparently like his later stuff goes, I like recently translated stuff is very Desaudian and I haven't gotten to that yet. And it's like, I read a review, it's like, oh, I'm running around talking about Robrier. I think this later stuff gets really, really explicit and weird. You know, in that Bataille area of stuff, that it's always a little less, if only because my generation was like so fixated on it, I'm a little less interested in, you know, in the literature of excess. You know, it's like I want an emotional core, but there's a lot of play that I want to do with writing to see what comes up.
I've been talking with John Darnielle, author of Wolf and White Van, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, also the core man of the Mountain Goats. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Wolf and White Van at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Why not join the Angel Book Club and get books like John Darnielle's 5 times a year. We choose them especially for you. I write a note telling you why I've made the choice. Come on, be an angel. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Sarah Waters is our guest.